Good afternoon, Sunday afternoons. Steve Dale here with you on WGN. And I want to get right to this. I'm so honored that he's doing this. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases since 1984. I can go on and on with a further introduction, but I have so many questions for Dr. Fauci. So I want to get right to those. Dr. Fauci, thank you so much for joining us today on WGN. It is more than appreciated.
Well, my pleasure. It's good to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Well, you know, I posted in social media that you'd be on the air, and the overwhelming majority of people, and WGN posted on their social platforms as well, said, I mean, this guy's amazing. This is wonderful. This will be really interesting and educational. But a significant percent of people still say around America, and I want to ask you about this. So many people, most people say, thank you. This is incredible. But say, well, this is a hoax. It's not real. The flu numbers and COVID numbers are being combined. They're overdiagnosing this. I'm sure you've heard this all before. The latest from today, actually, is 2 million cases. 2 million cases, according to Johns Hopkins University. But how do you deal with these people that truly, truly believe in their soul that this is all somehow made up?
You know, it's a very, very difficult situation because that degree of clinging on to things that are just not true is a reflection not only what we're seeing with regard to the public health issue of COVID, but we're also recently seeing it in the political arena, which you know so well, of the events of which happened over the past few days right here in Washington, D.C.
Yeah,
I don't have an easy answer to that. The only thing I can point out to people, you know, who may reject it out of hand, is that take a look at what's going on in the hospitals throughout the country. And we have had situations where you're in a state, a city, or a region where the hospitals are overwhelmed with critically ill individuals. The hospitals that have 20 intensive care unit beds and have 50 intensive care unit patients waiting to be taken care of, they're being stretched to the limit. And even in those regions, some people still think it's fake news or that it's a hoax or that it's made up. It's incomprehensible that that is going on. And I'm not going to solve it in any discussion with you, but I think the country needs to really, really examine where we are and the degree of divisiveness that has spilled over into our attempts to address a very critical, historic public health challenge. And it does nothing but get in the way of an effective response. When you have people who don't believe the reality that's staring them right in the face, you know, we've had now over 360, 370,000 deaths. We're averaging 2,000 to 3,000 deaths per day and 200 to 300,000 infections. These are real. Go to the hospitals and talk to the healthcare providers who are knocking themselves out 24/7 to take care of these people. These are real people, real numbers, and it's not a hoax.
Yeah, and I'd love to stay on that issue in a sense because I think it needs to be talked about more. Having said that, there's so much I want to talk to you about, so many questions I have and from listeners, including this one. Aside from age and comorbidities or other illnesses people may have, do we know why some people at this point, do we know why some people do get sick and others seem to have no symptoms whatsoever or something in between? Some people get sick and then they don't exactly recover, the so-called long haulers. Do we know what separates different people from all of that? Do we have any idea at this point?
Yeah. You know, that's an excellent question that in all of my experience of dealing with infectious disease outbreaks over, you know, about 40 years, we've never seen anything like this. It is true that those who are elderly and those who have underlying conditions have a greater propensity to have a serious outcome of COVID-19. But the thing that we don't have a crisp, clear answer on is that why so many people, particularly young people, get infected and have either no symptoms at all or just mild to moderate symptomatology. Whereas other people, including some young people, clearly overwhelmingly the people who get into trouble are elderly, but we certainly have many examples of individuals who are young, in their 30s, in their 40s, and even in their 20s, who get into serious trouble. Why they get into trouble, and the overwhelming majority of younger people don't, we don't know. You can hypothesize that the level of receptors in the nose, in the throat, and in the lung of people who do well is very low, whereas the receptors for the virus are very high in those who get into trouble. But that's just surmising. We don't know that as a fact, which is the reason why we still have a lot to learn about this very perplexing disease. The one thing we do know, that in those that it does make critically ill, it is really leading to a very, very serious number of people who are getting sick and dying from this, despite the fact that many, many, many people do really quite well.
I want to talk about therapeutics. So ivermectin, an antiparasitic, appears to work in vitro. There are monoclonal antibodies that are really hard to get, but they do seem to work for people that are ill. We know about remdesivir. That's been talked about. And now there have even been studies about vitamin D deficiency. And if you can overcome that, your chances of at least some protection are increased. What do we know? What don't we know? And what do we think we know?
Well, when it comes to therapy, there are things that have been anecdotal, namely that have not been done in a clinical trial that you can give a good scientific basis for a clinical decision. And there are others that have actually gone through the clinical trial process and have shown to be effective. And you have to divide it up into therapies for early disease to prevent people from progressing on to serious disease versus therapies for people who are already experiencing serious disease, such as those who are in intensive care or those who require ventilation. We know that a drug, a common drug that we've had for years called dexamethasone, when people have advanced disease or in the hospital either require ventilation or have considerable lung disease, that drug has now been shown very clearly to have a major benefit in increasing the 28-day survival, in other words, diminishing the 28-day mortality. So that's one good thing. Then there have been a number of drugs that have either been tested or in the process of being tested that have shown some benefit a bit early on in the disease, namely preventing people from progressing. Monoclonal antibodies is one of those that have shown in a number of studies to be promising enough to be given an emergency use authorization. Remdesivir, which directly attacks the virus in individuals who have some lung involvement, has also been shown in a clinical trial to have a benefit in diminishing the time to recovery so that you recover much more. Then there are a whole bunch of other drugs, including ivermectin, which shows some in vitro effect against the virus. Right now, there are clinical trials going on to determine if, in fact, it does have any benefit. We don't know that it does, but we don't know that it doesn't either, and that's the reason why clinical trials are being done. So there are a number of drugs that are in the process of either being tested or who have been tested and shown not to work, such as hydroxychloroquine, which there was a lot of debate about that. Mm-hmm. But the overwhelming number of studies have shown that it is not helpful in COVID-19 disease.
All right, that's Dr. Anthony Fauci. We'll be back after a break, Dr. Fauci. I want to ask you about, and actually so many listeners have wanted me to ask you about the mutations that have occurred, and also lots of questions concerning vaccines. All next on WGN. Steve Dale with you on WGN. It is 1:19. Good afternoon. I'm not here alone. I'm here with the one and only Dr. Anthony Fauci. I want to ask you, Dr. Fauci, about the mutations. We've heard so much about those. There was one study in the UK that indicated, this one particular study, that yes, it is more infectious. People are more likely to get COVID as a result of this mutation. But having said that, they are less likely to become as ill. It's as if the study said, essentially, the virus, if it were a thinking being, knows enough to know that if I kill my host, I don't get to keep going. So I'm not going to make these hosts as sick as has been in the past. Does this make any sense to you?
Theoretical way, but we've got to be careful, because even though it inherently, on a one-to-one basis, may not make a person more sick or lead to more death, the fact is that the more infections you get in the community, the more people are going to get hospitalized, and the more people that are going to get hospitalized, some of them are going to die. So even though it is inherently not more pathogenic, and pathogenic means like on a case-by-case basis, it could make somebody more sick or lead to them having a severe outcome. But at the end of the day, if a virus is more transmissible and gets more people sick, that among those, some of them are going to get hospitalized and some of them are going to die. So even though it doesn't inherently give you more pathogenicity, I don't think we should take lightly the fact that it is leading to much more efficient infections, at least according to the Brits. Now, we have this particular mutant in our own country, not to the prevalence that they have in the UK. So we are going to study this very intensively ourselves for a few reasons. One, to determine if, in fact, there is not any increase in pathogenicity, but also to determine if the mutation is going to give us a problem with the vaccines that we're dealing with. Thus far, according to the Brits and according to the company, it does not appear to interfere with the vaccines that we're using. But we want to make sure of that, and that's the reason why we're going to study that very intensively. We take these very seriously. We don't want people to panic about it, but we don't want to just blow it off. This is something we have to follow very closely.
Incoming President Biden said that he's releasing all vaccine. Are you concerned that people may not get their second dose of the vaccine?
No, actually, no. The plan is that they do not want to have vaccine essentially being in a refrigerator, not being used when there are so many people that can benefit for it. That has somehow been misinterpreted, that they're not worried about a second dose and they don't care if there's going to be a... No, not at all. Clearly, the commitment to getting people their second dose on time, which would be 21 days after the Pfizer prime and 28 days after the Moderna prime, there has not at all been an abandonment of the commitment to get people their second dose. They just don't want to have a lot of vaccines sitting around waiting for something, as opposed to getting it into people as efficiently as possible.
Now, our mayor knows that I'm talking to you, so Mayor Lori Lightfoot of Chicago. And Chicago public health officials have said they're hugely concerned, because at the rate we're going, we're talking about all the people who want to be vaccinated will be in a year and a half, which, if that were true, I would assume you'd agree is way too long.
Oh, absolutely. And I think also that you're going to see an acceleration of vaccine. What happened is that the original projection was to get 20 million doses delivered and distributed and 20 million doses into the arms of people by the end of December. Clearly, that has not happened, and they need to do much better than that. But remember, this was a brand new program of a magnitude to which we've never had to deal before, and it was initiated right in the middle of the holiday season between Christmas and New Year's. So there were some stumbling blocks and some hiccups, as it were, if you want to call it that. I would give it another week or so to see if we can get back on the pace that was originated, which would mean we could get this done in several months and not more than a year, because we really do want to get this done. We want to get the priority people vaccinated, by priority, the ones that have been designated by the CDC, nursing homes, healthcare providers, people with essential jobs, the elderly, et cetera. If we can get them done in the next few months, so that by the time we get to April, that we can essentially have what I would call open season, namely anybody, even if you're not in a priority group, can get vaccinated, and we put a full court press on that and get people vaccinated in April, May, June, July, and August, we could get, and I've used this as an estimate, which I think is a reasonably accurate estimate, that if we could get 70 to 85% of the people in this country vaccinated, that we could develop a degree of herd immunity that would have a major impact on slowing down this outbreak. And hopefully by the fall of 2021, we could start approaching some degree of normality.
Should we be using veterinarians, veterinarian dental technicians, retired doctors and nurses to vaccinate so we can get more of the vaccine into arms?
You know, that is something that is certainly should be seriously considered. If the stumbling block or the lesion here is that we don't have enough people out there doing the last final step of sticking the needle in someone's arm and getting them vaccinated, then we should be using whoever we can that are qualified. And there are many people. You mentioned some, but there are also medical students and dental students who clearly, I remember when I was a medical student, it would not be a big deal giving an intramuscular injection to somebody.
Right. When are we going to have real at-home testing so we can go to Walgreens without a prescription or CVS and get that for $3.99? Is that a possibility?
That is, and I'm glad you brought it up because that's something that I have been pushing for now for some time, is to get a point of care, highly sensitive, highly specific, inexpensive test that you can get yourself and read yourself without the necessity of a prescription or having a company or somebody else besides you looking at it, something that you could get in a pharmacy without a prescription. I think that is doable, and I think we should try very hard to get that, because if we did and we were able to flood the system with testing, people would have a very good idea of whether or not they can out and engage in an activity, or if they wanted to see if someone else was infected, namely if you wanted to have a meeting of a group of people, to be able to have within your own power the ability to do that. So I am very much in favor of having those home-type tests that people can do on themselves.
You know, I wish more than any other, any guest I've ever had on the radio, and I've had 1,000, 2,000, I don't know, that I could have more time with you, Dr. Fauci, because I have so many more questions to ask you. One is this. Could there be, I'm sure you've heard the term One Health. I know you spoke to the convention of the American Veterinary Medical Association. I was there watching you speak virtually last year. One Health is about the intersection between animals, ourselves, human beings, and the environment. This all began as a result of that intersection, probably from bats, but however it happened. We can learn a lot from bats, or for that matter, cats, that actually seem to get COVID and all sorts of coronaviruses in the case of bats asymptomatically. How are they able to do it? I would love to hear that there could be a task force, a commission, some sort of group brought together of veterinarians, of public health officials such as yourself, a virologist, a wide variety of experts to look in more detail at this and how we can prevent this from happening down the road.
Well, I agree with you completely. If you look at the numbers, I think most people don't fully appreciate about 70 to 75% of the new infections that afflict mankind are what we call zoonotic. Namely, they jump species from an animal reservoir into human. And if you look at the ones that we faced lately, I mean, look at all of them. It goes back to HIV/AIDS, which originated in a chimpanzee and a non-human primate. You look at many of the influenzas. You look at COVID-19. These are things that actually jump species that started off in an animal reservoir. So you're absolutely correct. We need to study that interface much more intensively.
Well, I hope there is some sort of task force that can bring this wide variety of folks together. And if there's anyone to do that on the planet, Dr. Anthony Fauci, you're it. My gratitude for the time you did spend with us. I am so grateful. And I know I am speaking for Chicago, and I'm speaking for so many of our listeners.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.